how would you like to make the money LeBron James makes in the NBA? As one of the best paid American athletes, he pulls in more than $70 million in a year. But there are people who make even more than he does, and they never have to dribble a basketball, let alone put it through a hoop. We're talking, of course, of corporate CEOs. The biggest compensation packages out there can net a CEO more than $100 million in a year. Sure, it's not all cash. There are stock options and other goodies in there. But is anybody worth that much? Today's guest explores the asking of that question and the answers it produces in his book, Indispensable and Other Myths: Why the CEO Pay Experiment Failed and How to Fix It. Michael Dorff is the author. He's our guest. He's taught at the law schools at both UCLA and Rutgers University and at the famed School of Management at Claremont Graduate University. He currently teaches corporate law and other business law topics at the Southwestern Law School in Los Angeles. Michael Dorff, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me. It's good to be here.
You begin in 2008 when the economy was hitting the fan, and as you write, you expect CEOs to be fired in these situations. Why didn't they get fired?
Well, I actually, when I say we might expect CEOs to be fired, that doesn't necessarily mean I think they ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
What we have is this mythology that whatever happens to the company is because of the CEO. And that's a very natural intuition. I mean, people have done studies that show that even when you appoint someone as leader of a group, and even when the task is determined by the success of the task is determined by random events, the people attribute the success or failure of the group to the leader. So it's very natural for us to attribute whether the company succeeds or fails to the leadership. But actually, when we're talking about these enormous publicly traded companies, their success or failure really has very little to do with the CEO. It has much more to do with broader economic variables. So if you look at, for example, today's market, you know, we're up some 200 points. That's not because any particular CEO did anything. It's because the Fed decided not to raise interest rates for a while. So those kinds of macroeconomic variables have much larger impact on company success or failures. And 2008 was a great example of that.
So this really works in both directions. You're saying they not only should not be blamed terribly for things going south on them, but they also should not be given so much credit for things that go really well.
I think that's exactly right. I think our natural tendency is to give pretty much 100% credit and often 100% blame for things that are really beyond the CEO's control. And the right answer isn't zero. It's not that CEOs have no impact, but on average, they probably have very little impact. And there's been a number of attempts to measure that. It's not easy to measure that even after the fact. But the efforts to measure that estimates have ranged from somewhere between 0 and 15% in terms of the CEO's impact on bottom line corporate outcomes like earnings per share or share price. So to give them credit or to blame them entirely for that, I think is really misguided.
And as you point out, too, in one of the chief examples given here from 08, when things began to get really bad with the economy and companies were tanking left and right and requiring bailouts, AIG did fire its CEO, but that CEO also got a big severance package.
Yes, he did.
How big was that? Do you remember off the top of your head?
In the tens of millions, I think. I don't remember off the top of my head.
Interesting. So,
all right. Yeah.
Not as much of as an important point that the number is, just the fact that here again.
$47 million. I just found it.
$47 million.
Yeah.
Wow. So, I mean, the question can certainly be up front: is anybody worth $47 million as a regular sort of thing? But then this is the, you know, gee, you did a bad job. Get out of here. Goodbye. Here's $47 million.
It's a nice parting gift.
It really is. But it boggles the mind for average Americans. And yet it seems like corporate America is immune to the sound of us scratching our heads out here.
Well, you know, they didn't used to be. We're accustomed to thinking of this as an insolvable problem and a problem that's gone on forever. It's about a generation old, actually. So when you look further back in the data, when you look back to from the late 1930s until about the mid-70s, CEO pay was actually constant in real terms. That is, when you pull out inflation, CEO pay at the largest public companies was at about, in today's dollars, about $1.4 million. So that's a lot less than what they're being paid now. So one of the real interesting mysteries for me about CEO pay is what changed in the late 70s. Why is it that CEO pay, which had been very stable for a very long time and by today's standards very modest, what changed? And so those people, the finance theorists who say, well, CEO pay is a product of an efficient market, that CEOs are really contributing as much to their companies or more as they're being paid, really have to explain why that changed. Why were CEOs worth so much less in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s than they are now in real terms? I think that's a very hard explanation to make. What actually happened was a shift in culture and a shift in the way that we pay CEOs that led to a shift in culture as well. So we, in the 70s, we started paying CEOs based on how the company did, in particular based on how the share price did. We didn't used to do that. In the back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, et cetera, we paid CEOs mostly as salary, a little bit of short-term bonus, but the vast majority of their pay package was just a straight salary. While we were doing that, CEO pay stayed flat. It stayed the same. And companies, you know, in the 50s and 60s did extremely well. So it's not that we are suffering at the time because companies were paying based on salary and not based on share price. But when we started paying based on share price, especially with options, you combine that with the bull market of the 80s and 90s, and you get rapidly increasing CEO pay. I mean, the rate of pay went from, you know, from the rate of change of pay went from about zero, right, in the 50s and 60s, went up by about 20% in the 70s, but then went up by 50% in the 80s and 125% in the 90s. That's entirely because of the way we're paying them, not because they're worth more.
All right. We'll get more into the pay structure and the two schools of thought. We already heard about the market efficiency idea versus crony capitalism. Those are the basic competing theories that Michael Dorff brings up in Indispensable and Other Myths, Why the CEO Pay Experiment Failed and How to Fix It. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Michael and your questions and comments when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Michael Dorff, professor of law at Southwestern Law School in Los Angeles, observer of corporate behavior, and author of the book Indispensable and Other Myths, Why the CEO Pay Experiment Failed and How to Fix It. Why do CEOs make eight and sometimes even nine-figure compensation packages? And who's behind all that? And what can we do to change that? Join us on the Exchange as we explore the questions and get some answers as well. Phone number here, 800-838-3760, your number for discussion around the region, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So, Michael, I want to come back because you're talking about until the 1970s, there wasn't a great increase in CEO pay. A couple things we can track here that might be part of the equation. The taxes were relatively high, certainly through the 50s and into the 60s, and it seems like attitudes began to change about how much people should be paying out in taxes and at the same time change some views about what should be coming into their pockets as well.
Yeah, there are a number of people who tie rising income inequality to taxes. I'm not sure, and that may be fair. I'm not sure how much of the change in CEO pay has to do with tax policy. We have seen, actually, what people often point to for in terms of taxes and CEO pay is not so much the tax rates, but a change that came in under the Democratic administration, the Clinton administration in 1993. When Bill Clinton was elected, he was elected in part on a platform, on a sort of populist platform, saying CEO pay is too high, and they were going to put in a cap of CEO pay on $1 million, not indexed for inflation, just $1 million. And at the last minute, they put in an exception to that cap for any pay that was related to performance, which included, by statute, it included stock options. So there are a lot of people who tie the change in structure of pay to that moment. But actually, that was a result of lobbying by companies that were already doing that. So the change in structure really started, you know, a decade and a half earlier than that. So, you know, what we do see in tax policy is it often reflects the existing power dynamics and existing trends. So we had a shift in the 70s, I think, that was largely based on a change in culture. And there was the rise in the tendency of economics to influence other disciplines. So you got economics in political science, we got economics in law, and not surprisingly, we got a lot of economics in corporate governance, and in particular in CEO pay. So two economists named Jensen and Meckling really embodied this. They wrote this article in the late 70s where they pushed very hard that we should stop paying paying CEOs like bureaucrats. We should start paying them based on how they do. And that seems very intuitive, right? It's a very intuitive notion that if we pay CEOs based on how the companies do, they'll work harder, they'll work smarter, and companies will do better. And if that had worked out, that would have been terrific. Unfortunately, there's no empirical data that really supports that notion.
So back to the concept itself of tying CEO compensation to the share price, it seems like a couple of voices would have said a few things. Number one, the people who were being put in this position might have said, "What? I can't affect the share price, not that much anyway." And the other school of thought probably would have been from somebody other than the CEO saying, this is going to lead to some monkeying around with the books to make the share price look better or to get people to buy more of the stock, therefore driving the share price up.
Well, it certainly has led to some of that. There's a lot of data that supports the notion that when you tie pay to particular metrics, there's a lot of incentive for the CEOs to try to make sure those metrics are high, whether they are legitimate or not. And there are quite a few studies that show that when you start tying pay to performance in that way, that people will try to do that. So even for things like share price, there are ways of sort of juicing the stock price a bit, even though CEOs don't have a lot of influence over stock price. So you can do things to make the earnings look better by cutting, for example, research expenses. So in that way, you're kind of eating your seed corn, but it does make the chickens look fatter for a little while. So that is a serious problem. Why didn't people stop? At the time, I think it was sort of part of the zeitgeist, right? It was part of the culture. The late 70s, remember, things were not going so well in the country. And so people were looking around trying to figure out, well, what's going wrong? Why are we doing poorly? And they seized on something that, had not changed since the 1930s. But this idea that we're not paying them in a way that motivates them properly. And that's a very intuitive idea, and so people didn't demand proof of it. They just sort of assumed it was right. It met with their everyday experience. It probably met with how they raised their children, right? You want your kid to make your bed. You say, well, you want your allowance, you got to make your bed. And for things like making your bed, it may work pretty well, although once they go off to college or wherever, once they leave home, they may not make their bed anymore once the salary comes away, once the tie to their allowance goes away. It doesn't work very well, though, for things like creative, analytical tasks that we want CEOs to do. And there's a lot of psychological studies that show that. One of my favorites was done in India, in rural India. Often these kinds of experiments don't have enough money to really mimic the kinds of pay that CEOs get. So they took that what was not a lot of money in America and went to rural India and tried these experiments there. And they gave people tasks ranging from sort of mechanical tasks to really creative analytical tasks. And they paid them different levels in different iterations of the experiment. So some people got a sort of a base level of pay based on how they did. And that was pretty good money, but not great money. Then they paid other people 10 times that amount, and yet other people 100 times that amount. And the 100 times, the very highest range of payments, were about 6 months spending for these folks. So that's a lot of money, right? 6 months spending. Mm-hmm. Imagine in a few hours experimentation, a few hours of game plan, you could make 6 months pay or 6 months spending. That would be amazing. And you think you'd be very highly motivated to do better. And, even at a tenth of that, that's pretty good money. A hundredth of that, maybe not so much. So they found actually for these kinds of tasks, these kinds of creative and analytical tasks, that there was no difference in performance between the base level and the one that was 10 times higher, which is already an extraordinary result. But when they paid them 100 times as much, when they could potentially have earned as much as 6 months spending, performance actually declined quite a bit. It got worse. And I think what we see with CEOs is the same sort of thing, so that even if CEOs could influence their company's performance, performance pay is not a way to get them to do that. It makes people focus on the pay and the metrics of the pay instead of focusing on what they're doing. So imagine if you're trying to shoot a basket from half court. If you're in your backyard or if you're in your high school gym and there's nobody around, you might be able to do it. It might take you a few times. You might be able to do it, but you're going to be focused just on shooting the basket for its own sake. You'll do a better job. If you're in front of a stadium of 50,000 people, you're going to be thinking about those 50,000 people and how embarrassed you're going to be if you miss. You're not going to be focused on getting your form right, and you won't do as well.
When you talk about the creative analytical things that people expect CEOs to do to earn their performance stuff, it makes me realize that generally what they're looking for is other creative analytical people to get under them, which I think would probably lead to more of a merger and acquisition sort of thing, where the best way they can increase the stock price and the company's value in the near term certainly is to combine it with other things, buy out other operations and bring more creative people under their tent, potentially more products, more services, et cetera.
Well, there is a real danger of that. You know, we call this the empire building theory of mergers and acquisitions. And CEOs do tend to get paid more when they're running a larger company. So the hard way of growing your company and earning more money is to grow your business, that is to do better at your business, get more market share, develop new products. The easier way is to buy another company, and especially if you buy it for cash or debt instead of using share, instead of issuing new stock, that automatically juices your earnings per share. Right? You have the same number of shares out there, but now you're earning more money. As long as the increased income can service your debt and still make a profit, then you automatically make more money per share, and you look like a growing company. You look like a bigger, better company, even though nothing has really changed except that you've now brought another company under your umbrella. So you're absolutely right that performance pay can have some very perverse incentives. It's not that incentives don't matter. It's that they don't affect people in the way that we expect them to affect it, and it can lead to these kinds of manipulations that you're talking about.
Michael B. Dorff is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, law professor at the Southwestern Law School in Los Angeles. His book is Indispensable and Other Myths, Why the CEO Pay Experiment Failed and How to Fix It. Join this discussion on the Jefferson Exchange. Your thoughts about CEO pay and the levels it has reached and why it has gotten there and what can be done about it. 800-838-3760 around the region. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So again, part one of the book is divided into three parts. What's wrong with the dominant theories? And the two competing ones we already identified are the idea that there's market efficiency setting pay versus crony capitalism setting. And you have found issues with both theories. Neither one seems particularly solid to you.
That's correct. I don't think either one really matches the data when we really look far enough back. So I already talked a little bit about why I think the market efficiency people are wrong. But we can also talk about why the major critique of CEO pay has come from people who think it's all because the directors are being bribed by the CEO, or they're bribing the CEO. There's sort of some mutual bribery going on where the directors like their jobs. They don't work very hard as a director. The surveys show about 250 hours a year, yet they're paid quite well. Directors of Fortune 500 companies can make several hundred thousand dollars a year. For not much work, right? Maybe about a month's work a year. So that sounds pretty good to people. And so the theory is that CEOs have a lot of influence over who gets appointed as a director and who gets to remain a director. Because although they're officially elected by the shareholders, really it's like elections in the old Soviet Union. There's really only one candidate. So the shareholders don't have much of a choice except when someone's trying to take over the company. So really it's whoever the board nominates gets reelected in almost every case. So there's a theory that CEOs have power over who gets elected to the board, and the directors want to stay on the board. The best way to please the CEO is to reward the CEO with lots and lots of money. That doesn't really work, I think, when you look at the data. So one of the most important reasons, I think, is that directors now are much more independent than they were in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. So back then, a third to a half of directors tended to be what we call inside directors. That is, they were officers of the company who worked under the CEO. They were the vice presidents, the chief operating officers, the general counsel. Those folks whose jobs depended on the CEO could fire them at will, they were on the board. So they had much more motivation to bribe the CEO with high pay than today's directors do. Today's directors tend to be outside directors, almost all of them. Tend to be outside directors. They're other corporate officers from other companies. They are former politicians. They are occasionally academics. But they're not people whose day-to-day salary depends on this CEO. And so if we thought that it was really about board corruption, about directors trying to please their boss, the CEO, we should have seen the exact opposite pattern from what we did see. We saw CEO pay suddenly rising just as companies and just as directors are becoming much more independent. That seems like the opposite of what we would expect to see.
Well, it seems like it becomes something of a groupthink, though, that if you're on the board of directors for with all these interlocking directorships, if you're on the board for a company that's shelling out $40 million a year for a CEO, then if you're on the board for this other company, you're not really going to question a $20 million CEO compensation package.
Yes, I think that's definitely true. I think that there has been a ratcheting effect for sure. So as we started tying, you know, one thing that when we changed structure, when companies changed the structure of pay, it tended all to be additive. So it wasn't that they said, well, we used to pay you $1 million in salary, now we'll make it half salary and half stock option. They said, well, we'll take your $1 million salary and then we'll add $1 million in options. So that was the first problem, was it was additive rather than substitutive. But also, as that happened and as the market went up, the realized pay for CEOs started rising very rapidly. And as it rose, it changed the culture, right? So now if I'm a CEO and I made $2 million last year, I expect to make at least that next year. But if they give me what they think will be $2 million worth of stock options and the market goes up more than everyone expects, which is what was happening in the early 80s, then instead of paying me $2 million, which is what they thought they were paying me, they actually paid me $3 million. Well, but I got $3 million last year now. So now I want, for the next year, I want $3 or $3.5 million. And that same thing keeps happening as they estimate the value of stock options based on what they think the market will do, but the market keeps climbing faster than people expect. The amount of pay people get and their expectations about pay kept ratcheting up.
That's a really important point, because when you think about it, if the people who set the salary with the stock options are thinking, well, there's no way this guy's going to get more than 15% next year than he got this year, and he ends up getting, you know, 120% of what he got this year, doesn't want to go backwards, certainly.
Exactly right. I'm not stupider than I was last year. I'm not working less hard than I did last year, and the company's doing better. So if anything, I should get paid more.
Michael Dorff, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, his book about CEOs, Indispensable and Other Myths. Haven't asked the key question about what the current ratio is. I see different versions of it, but last I saw it was something north of 400 times. CEO pay is 400 times what the average worker makes.
Well, so it depends on where you get your numbers from and how you measure average worker and how you're whether you're looking at realized CEO pay or anticipated CEO pay. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot that are in the weeds. Probably a better number is a little bit south of 300, but it's still very high. I mean, whether it's 300 or 400 is really, it's an exercise for people like me, but it's not something most people would care about. It's a very high number, and in the late 60s, it was around 25, to give you a sense of just how much it's grown. And that's because average worker pay has been more or less stagnant. It's grown a little bit over the last few decades, but it's been pretty much stagnant in real terms.
In real wages, yeah.
In real wages, while CEO pay has gone through the roof in real terms.
So how does CEO pay in American-based corporations differ from the rest of the world, though? I mean, has the rest of the corporate world gone this way?
Well, they're starting to converge, but it has long been written about that CEO pay in America is much higher than it is in Japan or Germany or even the U.K., and there's been a lot of speculation about why that is, and, you know, everyone uses that data point to push their own particular theory. But actually, most of the difference there was a study by Kevin Murphy at USC that showed this recently, that most of the difference can be accounted for by two things. One is a difference in company size. U.S. companies do tend to be larger on average. But more importantly, the difference in the way we pay our CEOs, that U.S. CEOs are paid based on performance. We tie CEO pay to share price, whereas in Germany and historically in the U.K., although less so in Japan, it has tended to be much more fixed salary and short-term bonus. And when you account for that, that really accounts for the vast majority of the difference in pay between U.S. CEOs, who, again, are paid much more even now than German CEOs and even British CEOs. But there is more and more convergence. More and more countries are moving towards a performance-based pay model. And as we see that, the delta, the difference between what U.S. CEOs are paid and what German and Japanese CEOs are paid is starting to shrink.
You know, one of the things I'm struck by is, you know, watching in my own salary negotiations over the years, for example, it's clear to me that obviously employers want to get as much work for as little money as they generally want. Boards don't tend to think that way, though, do they? Certainly not where the CEO is concerned.
Well, I think, again, we go back to this mythology that the CEO is solely responsible for corporate performance. And so what one director told me once is, we don't care about a few million dollars if we have to pay him. We're not going to worry about, or her, we're not going to worry about an extra couple of million dollars. This person's going to make us billions. And it's that mythology that makes directors feel like it's their job, it's their duty, their fiduciary duty to the shareholders to make sure they get the right person, even if that person is expensive, because the amount of money at stake seems enormous.
Is there even a status thing to it, like somebody at General Motors board saying, well, there's no way we can pay less than Ford, for example?
Yeah, I do think there's a little bit of that. I mean, more of it has to do with comp consultants and looking at comparable CEOs and making sure that our CEO should be paid either at or above the median for comparable companies, because, of course, our CEO is at least as good as those folks.
Michael Dorff, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book about CEOs, Indispensable and Other Myths. We'll come back and talk more with Michael and take your phone calls and emails. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Michael Dorff from the Southwestern Law School in Los Angeles. He has taught at law schools and has also taught at the School of Management at Claremont Graduate University, written a book about CEO pay called Indispensable and Other Myths, Why the CEO Pay Experiment Failed and How to Fix It. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about CEO salaries and compensation packages generally, which do get up into nine figures. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 around the region, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. One of the intriguing things you dug up in your search for data that helps support pretty much anything in CEO rises is the issue of who owns the shares of corporations now. The composition of the shareholder body is different from what it was back when CEO salaries were lower.
It is quite different. We have very short-term shareholders now. So, you know, way back in the 60s, 70s, average shareholder held onto their stock for about six or seven years. And now the average shareholder holds on to their stock for about 6 or 7 months. So you hear directors complaining, or at least I hear directors complaining, that no sooner do we get notice, do they get notice that there's someone has taken a large position in the company, you know, 1 or 2% of the company, then they're getting phone calls from that person saying, we want you to do something to boost the stock price right away so we can show a quick profit. We want you to do a stock buyback at a premium, or we want you to pay a big dividend. We want you to send out all your cash or something to do a quick juice of the stock price so that we can make a quick return. That makes corporate reform really hard, because the people we would normally go to are the shareholders. We'd say, aren't you in this for the long term? Don't you want to make sure the company is well run? And the answer for a lot of shareholders is no, we don't really care. What we really want is a quick return, and then we're going out and moving on to the next thing. So in many ways, this sort of rise of the hedge fund investor, or the quick in and out investor, is one of the biggest problems we have in corporate governance.
I guess I was going to ask about shareholders putting up fights over CEO pay. It sounds like if the shareholders aren't there for that long, they don't really care what the CEO gets paid as long as they get some money out of it.
It does seem that way. In fact, you know, we moved to say on pay votes, they're advisory votes, but a few years ago it became mandatory that public companies in the U.S. have a vote from the shareholders on whether the CEO pay is acceptable or not. And about 98% of those votes have been favorable. So shareholders are not using their newfound power to express some criticism of the CEO pay.
Let's take some calls. We have Jenny and Roseburg on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Michael Dorff, the author of Indispensable and Other Myths.
Hi. So I just wanted to share an anecdote. I used to work with the senior executive on a management on a UK multinational, Courtauld PLC. And it was in the late 80s, early 90s, and I was there for the transition from one CEO to another. And the culture change was just phenomenal between one to the next. I went from a CEO who used to request his personal phone calls be itemized so that he could pay the company back, to one who used to use company funds to go see the Grand Prix in South Africa and had a very, very fancy London apartment fitted out on company money, and his salary, the salary went up from, I'm going to say, like $3 million, probably like $750,000 to a million-ish, or $500,000 to $1 million. It was a big jump in salary. And then he was asking me and the technical team to be involved in helping him outfit his yacht in the latest technology for Tidal or whatever. And I just got so irritated because I was used to that kind of corporate responsibility, that sense of, you know, company resources are for the company, you'll take care of them collectively, mm-hmm. to this, you know, the company resources are mine to my own personal enjoyment. And I had a little hissy fit to somebody, and so they took over the project for me. But it was incredible to just watch that just overnight flip from one thing to the next. So it must have been in that period. But it seemed more cultural than anything, or don't know, personalities, the type of personalities that went into that. I don't know what was going on, but it was massive.
All right. Thanks for the story, Jenny. Appreciate that. And I imagine there are similar stories you ran across, too, of what had been a fairly austere approach to managing turned into a bit more lavish of a lifestyle.
Yeah, I do think that this is self-reinforcing. So when companies start paying CEOs based on how the company is doing, that sends a very strong message that they are entitled to a piece of the company's success. And I think we do sort of see that. There also, we haven't talked about this yet, but there was also a rise in the number of CEOs hired from outside the company. So it used to be that, it's still true that the majority of CEOs are hired from within, but it used to be that almost all CEOs were groomed from within the company. There were people who had been at the company a long time, and those people tend to have a stronger cultural affiliation with the company and feel more loyalty to the company. And so I like the story about the CEO who wanted their personal calls itemized so they could reimburse the company. That's the kind of sort of corporate loyalty that you get from someone who's spent their whole career there. It's harder to get that when you have the superstar model, which is what we tend to see increasingly now. And Rakesh Khurana at Harvard has written about this very, very nicely, where boards think that they want to get someone from outside the company to sort of save the company, to rescue the company, or to boost the company into the next level. And to do that, they feel like they need sort of a superhero. They need someone who has an international reputation. When you hire those kinds of people, it's natural that they, number one, don't have that same sort of cultural affiliation with the company. And number two, they're even more likely to believe that they're entitled to a piece of the company's success. Everyone is telling them they're there to save the company. They're there to transform the company. It's not surprising that they believe that, too.
Well, because their reputations are out there and all the other stuff, too. I mean, they get so tied in identity to the company. You can certainly see why they'd say, okay, I get a big chunk of this. Let's go to Leo and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Michael Dorf.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I would just like the author to tie in to the subject matter of the book, the fact that corporations used to pay, 40-50% in taxes through the 40s, 50s, and 60s, whereas nowadays with even more incredible profits, they sometimes pay zero taxes. That's my comment and question.
All right, not the individual taxes, but the corporate taxes. Thanks for that, Leo. Michael, your thoughts?
Well, I don't know that there is that may be a problem for all kinds of reasons, and I understand the concern about that for sure. I don't know that it has a strong tie to CEO pay, except in the sense that to the extent there's more money sloshing around, it's easier to give more of it to the CEO. But I don't think that company size or corporate tax rates have a lot to do with CEO pay, except in the very direct way that I mentioned earlier, that the deductibility of corporate pay has been tied to it being performance pay. So that's something that may have had some impact, although, again, I think it mostly solidified trends that were already ongoing.
Another call here from Julie in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Michael Dorf. His book is Indispensable and Other Myths.
Hi there. this is a little bit maybe far-fetched. It's sort of a connect the dots. But, you know, when there are people who have these high incomes, it starts to trickle into the economy and give it sort of a false boost. And I saw in California real estate really start going crazy. It was like an artificial acceleration. And I just wondered if he sees a tie in maybe the effect of them in the spending aspect of the economy. And also I have a question. Was he able to show that as these high-paid CEOs were in existence, that maybe the next higher-ups would start to trickle up higher into higher pay?
Interesting enough, the other company officers make piles of money as well. Thanks for that, Julie. Appreciate it. Michael?
So to take the second question first, the next level of executives, so the ones that are still required to be disclosed, they're the top five executives have to have their pay disclosed on corporate filings, on the SEC filings. They get paid a lot less than the CEO, but it is certainly true that they get paid a lot more now than they did a generation ago. So they have risen, but they've not risen as much as the CEO has. There's still a very large difference between the top spot and, in fact, a much larger difference between the top spot and the number two spot than there used to be. And there is a management, you know, Peter Drucker used, when he was, you know, the management guru, Peter Drucker, thought this was a terrible idea, that the CEO really shouldn't make very much more than the next person below and shouldn't make much more than the average worker, right? He thought a ratio of 20 or 25 was about as high as it should go, and now, of course, we're at something like 300. So there has been some trickle down in that sense, but not to the extent that you would think. There really, a lot of it has been a growing divide between the top spot and the next tier. In terms of impact on the broader economy, we're not talking about a huge number of people here. I mean, even if you go beyond the sort of Fortune 500 and go to maybe the top 1,000 publicly traded companies, it's not a huge number of people. And one thing that people who write about income inequality often talk about is that wealthy people spend a smaller percentage of their income than poor people. Poor people who need the money for food and for shelter and for clothing just to go from day to day tend to spend most of their income, whereas wealthy people save a lot of it. So although they do, you know, spend money on fancy cars and big estates and real estate and all that too, they don't spend in the same percentages that poor and middle class people do. And so if you really want to boost the economy, it's probably not ideal to increase income inequality. What you really want to do is reduce income inequality and make, you know, if you can do that without reducing total income. So to the extent that it's all about distribution to the extent that distribution would not otherwise impact total amount of income, you'd rather have it more evenly distributed because then it gets spent more.
You mentioned Peter Drucker. I want to bring in Derek Bach because you mentioned him in your book, book, The Cost of Talent. What points does he make on CEO pay?
Well, you know, Derek Bach had, you know, his book was about not just CEOs, but he was writing about why a number of different professions had increased in pay, although CEOs have increased much more than they. And he also seemed to think a lot of it was what we call an agency cost problem, this idea that directors are not doing a good enough job in reining in CEO pay. I mean, directors actually negotiate the pay with their CEOs, that they're not standing up to the CEO in the way that they should. And again, he had a number of reforms in mind. Most of those have been tried to try to make the directors more independent. And most of those have been tried without any real success, unfortunately. But he had the right idea in many ways that there was a problem. He certainly identified that very nicely.
So given that the expectations are now so high, I mean, if you're going to be the guy who succeeds Les Moonves at CBS, who made $65 million plus in compensation last year, you're probably thinking anything less than $40 million would probably be a slap in the face. So, I mean, how do we begin to make any changes in this way of looking at the world?
Well, I think it's going to be very difficult. But the first step is to, I think, get away from performance pay, because performance pay has an effect of masking the problem with pay. It makes us feel like, well, they're only being paid based on how they perform. Of course, it's not how they perform, but how the company performs. But it makes it, because we think that how those two things are the same, how the CEO performs is the same as how the company performs, we think they're only being paid based on their performance. That somehow seems just to a lot of people. So I think getting away from that would be very helpful. If we went back to straight salaries, it's much harder to justify paying someone $40 million salary than it is to justify paying them $40 million in stock or stock options, which are only stock options especially because they're only worth money if the share price goes up. Of course, share price tends to go up over time, but that's another story. So I do think if we went back to salaries, that would be a hugely helpful. There are a lot of barriers of doing that, not least of which is this tax law that I mentioned earlier, Section 162M of the tax code, that makes it very difficult and expensive for companies to pay straight salaries over $1 million. And then there's a cultural problem because we've been doing this now for 30 years and people are accustomed to it. They still find it very intuitive. And although the data doesn't support the notion that performance pay increases performance, people still believe it. I find when I go and give talks to directors and executives and even lawyers that, you know, I show them, I can't do this on the radio, but I show them my slides, I show them the data, and they're all very persuaded all the way along. And then at the end, they balk at the conclusion. They say, well, you really want to get rid of performance pay? So they believe me when I show them the data that says that this performance pay doesn't work, and yet they still, there's a disconnect. They can't quite move to the place that says...
Really? So there's no reason for it, you demonstrate, but then they say, but why would we want to do without it?
But we can't do it without it. How could we possibly... You're just going to pay them straight salary. We're not going to use it as a management tool at all. And that has to, I think, be the answer because it's not an effective management tool. So just like an outdated technology, you know, if you had a technology that didn't work, you would get rid of it or you would fix it. Here, this is a technology that doesn't work as a management tool, and yet people are remarkably reluctant to get rid of it.
Michael Dorff, can't wait for the sequel to Indispensable and Other Myths, why the CEO pay experiment failed and how to fix it. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been my pleasure.
All right, take care. And that'll do it for today's program. Find out more about the program at jeffexchange.org or on our Facebook page. The Jefferson Exchange is produced by Charlotte Duran of JPR News. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Join us next time, and please have a great day.